This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Dating back to pre-Columbian times, the scissor dance is described as being both a physical challenge between dancers and a veneration of nature. Declared an intangible cultural heritage of humanity by UNESCO in 2010, Malaysians will get to catch a rare staging of the scissors dance right here in Kuala Lumpur, performed by British Peruvian artist Jose Navarro. Jose joins me now for a crash course on this traditional art form. Welcome to the show, Jose.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation for this talk show, and I hope to be able to explain a bit more about this dance during the course of this interview. Thank you so much.
So firstly, let's talk about you a little. What spurred your love for the arts? You know, what was your first introduction to puppetry in particular?
Yes, I have started my career in the arts as a mime artist, actually. I learned classical mime art, and then I did for a while with a company, and then eventually I became a solo artist. And at some point I explored different possibilities within mime, and one of them was what I myself call body puppetry, which means I use different sections of my own body with some props like mostly eyeballs or fake noses, and I make the characters. And at the beginning it was like a kind of transition into puppetry, and that's a little bit how it got me more into puppetry, and eventually I learned more techniques in the coming years afterwards.
What interested you in mime to begin with? I mean, it's not exactly something that many people, I guess, on the street think about. You know, you don't wake up one day and decide, oh, I feel like today I want to go and learn some mime artistry.
Yes, I have seen mime once in my hometown. There was a theater festival. I'm from a remote village in Peru, in the highlands, and that was a kind of major event. I mean, it didn't happen every year or every 2 years or anything like that. It was just that. It was the chosen destination during that time. And then, luckily for me, I saw a mime artist, a classical mime artist. And then that memory kept in my mind. And I was trying to search for a master who could teach me, or a school where I can go and learn. And when I finished my secondary school and I moved to the capital, to Lima in Peru, and I studied art, I was looking for my master, and that time I was a little bit difficult. And fortunately, the person who taught me, that was living in Europe at that time, went back to Peru to live there again, and I was able to meet him, and he agreed to teach me. So that was a little bit kind of my journey into this art form and all the learning I had.
I read that you were trained in mime by Juan Arcos, who I guess is the person you were referring
yes.
to. And, you know, how much has he influenced your style, being the person who kind of brought you further into the art form?
In the context of my performance activity, I think I owe him a great deal, because most of my puppet works or dance even is quite influenced by what I've learned during the art form of mime. Because most of my shows are without words, are very physical, very visual. So the importance for the audience to be able to see what's happening on stage rather than listening what's going on there. So it's kind of big influence, because he shaped more or less the way I introduce all my shows nowadays.
And when you began to take more of an interest in puppetry, when did you transition away, you know, from mime towards puppetry and performance?
Yes, it happened like in 1999, and I started this like kind of exploration, because I had at home a small room with a mirror, so I can watch myself and kind of check the movements, the positions of my body when I was exploring. And one day when I was playing with my hands, I just placed them some eyeballs and a nose, and I found that interesting character. And then I said, okay, I'll keep exploring with this. At the beginning I showed to some people, because I wasn't sure where this is going to lead me.
Yeah.
But people laughed and said, oh, actually that's a big crazy idea. I think it's not viable. But anyway, I carry on, I explore more. At the beginning, I did a small piece with this, and it wasn't so successful because the materials I have chosen weren't right. But eventually, I got to kind of explore with other materials, and I developed a whole piece performance, which is called Animalia. It's one of my shows that has been shown in many places, and I didn't even thought that it was going to be like this. That was a little bit my transition into into other puppet techniques.
So you've told us about, you know, the characters that you create.
Yes.
What exactly goes into the performance? You know, what do you do?
Myself,
if it's possible to describe on radio.
Yes. Well, the topics I kind of represent are very diverse. Sometimes animal life, ancient gods, very mysterious ones, very abstract and very symbolic, which I myself don't know much about it. And a lot of my stuff is about tradition and heritage and identity. I have some of my works about the Amazon rainforest, the problems that it's facing right now, or the culture that surrounds and some. So I have to go there, live there for a while, get to know the people, the landscape, and then eventually I come up with some ideas which I represent. And the same was with the sister dance, because I come from a village where this tradition is kind of quite strong, but in even more remote villages than my village. It took me many, many years to find someone to teach me, because usually this is passed from a father to a son, or maybe a elder relative.
It's a generational thing.
There is no school to be able to learn this. Basically, you have to learn a little bit in that medium. And it took me many years to find someone who can actually teach me. And I always watch during the festivities the sister dancer competing when they came, like, during Christmas or New Year time.
So I guess with issues of identity and heritage, is a sense of place then very important? You know, the fact that you come from Peru, is that a very important aspect of your work?
I think it's almost unavoidable, because somehow I'm living now for 14 years almost in the UK. I'm settled there, but it's not the nostalgia, but it's that maybe my background in studying art history, with a strong kind of insight into pre-Columbian art and folk and popular art, gave me like this kind of awareness of what really my heritage is throughout the years. And somehow I ended up thinking that I should deal with these topics, because in Peru, if you see a little bit what's presented in the worlds of theater or arts in general, is quite influenced by European traditions. And I think there are many doing this, and quite successfully, and commercially viable. But it didn't interest me much, because I thought I come from somewhere and we have many other traditions. Maybe I could have a go with this.
And represent something
in representing else. Them through maybe mime, or through dance, or through puppetry, etc., or through music also.
You said earlier that you didn't expect the craft to kind of take you to where you've come today.
Yes.
Where has your craft allowed you to travel to? I understand that you've, you know, participated as a soloist at numerous festivals.
Yes, I was in almost all Europe. It's quite a lot within Eastern Europe, because Russia has influenced a lot of ex-USSR countries. And they have amazing facilities especially for puppeteers. They have buildings designed specifically for puppetry, sometimes even in the most remote villages. So big towns, of course, they have bigger facilities. So they organize a lot of festivals, and I was able to come also around these Asian kind of countries. I was in China, Thailand recently, now I'm here. I was in Armenia and South America quite a lot. I haven't been in Australia yet, Northern Africa. But somehow, because of the arts, basically, I end up somewhere else.
Yeah, you can start a countdown on the world map of all the places
yes.
you've been to. So with your performances, do you feel that they, you know, pass through all language boundaries? Because obviously the places that you've been to, the languages in some cases don't even share a common root, you know.
Yes.
So when they watch your performances, do you feel that you manage to transgress these boundaries?
I think in a way, yes. I couldn't say that body language is similar everywhere, but it's more common than spoken language, body language. Therefore, because all my shows are very visual, so I rely very little on text. I have maybe one of couple of shows that I use quite a lot of text, and usually it's in Spanish, one of them in English also. But most of them, they are very visual, and I have usually I work with sound designers and composers. They write the music for the shows, or there is music background all the time, and a lot of actions with the puppetry going on stage.
So body language.
Yes, and a lot of body language. and then I think this this allows me to show people some emotions, some ideas, and they can kind of follow through.
Without having to struggle through the language, if it was, say, all in Spanish, for example.
Yes, I think that would be a big, big problem. And since then, now I have, like, most of my shows that I have in mind that I might be able to travel with this. So I kind of devise in a way that it will suit different audiences in any part of the world. That's my idea.
I'm speaking today to Jose Navarro, an artist, about the Ritual Scissors Dance, which we'll be finding more about after the break on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today, Jose Navarro, an artist. We are talking about the Ritual Scissors Dance, and which is what you're here to perform, Jose. And from what I understand, it's an ancestral Peruvian Andean dance that has been included in UNESCO's Intangible Heritage of Humanity list. Now, I understand that not all scissor dance experts agree on the historic origin of the dance. What is your understanding of it?
Well, there have been few research about this dance, about its origin of the dance. And some of them, they say that it might come from Colombian times. And there was a dance that was called the Fast Steps. And apparently was this dance like kind of a duel between two or more dancers. That might be the background of this dance. But a lot of the research that went into this dance is mostly contemporary practice. So a few of them, they kind of found relevant information that to kind of explain really where it come from. But definitely, since the colony, we have like a little bit of mixture of cultures. It's quite influenced by Spain in some way, because the instruments that are played in this dance are the harp and violin, which came from Europe. But the music, the melodies are very Andean based.
So it's really hard to say. It might still come from all over the place to a certain extent.
Yes. In the area that originates is with Ayacucho, Apurimac, Huancavelica. It's a specific region in Peru which somehow people tend to be a little bit like, tend to resist to be imposed by something. And it was said that during the colony, the conquistadores, what we call them, they came and they grabbed the land, they grabbed many things. And maybe the mines, that's interesting for them. But one element that they were imposing was like the new religion, which is Christianity. And at that time, because we also in throughout the Americas had different kind of spiritual life, possibly religions. And the scissor dance came as a spiritual resistance to this new imposition that was happening in 16th century Latin America. And they say, well, everything has been taken, but not our soul. So it was a little bit like a spiritual resistance. And that meant that they have to dance for many days until they were very, very exhausted. And it was to honor the Mother Earth and the sun, which were kind of regarded as gods in that area.
Yeah. Another perspective, the symbolism of the scissors dance, according to Jose Maria Aguedas, one of Peru's greatest 20th century intellectuals, relates to an ecological process of life, death, and regeneration vis-a-vis the Womani deity. Would you know anything of this?
Yes. Actually, one of the scissors, it represents the male entity and the other is the female, which could mean one is the Mother Earth, the other is the sun. And because they are separated, but they have to kind of cling together. It's like fertility dancing. It has to do with this connection between the sun and the Mother Earth that gives life. But at the same time, this life is kind of temporary, cyclical. So we go through different seasons. And it's a little bit, that's the representation of this sort of dance. Even the choreography is a little bit like you go in circles, and at some point you stay somewhere, do a step, and then go back and keep moving. And all the time the season has to be played, because that's a little bit the idea of the symbolism of the dance, giving life and with certain gaps in between, which might mean like transitions or maybe a regeneration.
So we've talked about the symbolism of it. How is the dance performed? You know, for somebody watching, what would they be seeing?
I think people are quite much attracted because of the dexterity of the dancer, because it's a dance that requires a lot of physical strength and coordination, and you have to keep up with the beats also of the scissors, and the costume is very colorful. And some steps are very kind of like, there needs a little bit of strength from part of the dancer. And I think that's quite attractive. And usually I done in different contexts this dance, in small villages in Peru, in big halls somewhere else, in schools, some certain festivals. And people kind of tend to connect with this. And they think there is something spiritual about this dance. They always ask me, are you tired after that? And I say, no, I'm quite relaxed now. It's like all the heaviness of life goes in this dance. Yeah, you release, you become like if you had slept for many hours. And
it's cathartic.
Yes.
Does the choreography differ from dance to dance? I mean, in traditional dance, that's always something I'm interested in. So when you perform it in the modern context and I guess in different locations, that does it become adaptive, or is it something that is, you know, what's been performed 200 years ago is still what's being done today?
No, it's a dance that, like, I think most expressions in other parts of life is kind of changes throughout the time. And of course, there are like different contexts. In the traditional villages, what happens is you are hired for 5 days or 6 days or a week to dance in certain festivity, which you have to dance day and night with some gaps in between, maybe to eat or to drink or to have a little bit of chat. And then you have to dance many times a day, sometimes even at midnight or 4 o'clock in the morning. And there is a whole kind of sequence during different days in the dance, which ends up, this dance doesn't only involve dancing, but involves something else. And we ourselves have to go to certain mountains and give offerings and so on. But in Lima, in the capital, this dance is represented quite differently, because we don't have that time for doing our dance and
for
and
5 days.
Yes.
Yep.
So usually they may ask us to go to an event and maybe we dance 2 hours, 3 hours, and that's it. And we go home. Or maybe we go to another event or something like that. But in Europe, it's even less. I mean, it's like sometimes they ask you to dance for 10 minutes, 20 minutes as part of a bigger event where there are many other things happening.
As a showcase.
As a showcase.
Yep.
Yes.
So what gives the dance its name, Scissors Dance? It's quite intriguing.
Yes. The dancer actually wears in one of his hands a handkerchief, in the other hand, wears a glove, and on top of the glove he wears these two pair of metal blades. When they are put together, they have the shape of scissors, and they are actually not scissors. It is quite blunt, quite heavy, and with a very loud sound. It's like a percussive instrument. And because of this, for some reason, throughout the history, this dance is known as the scissor dance.
It could have been called the blade dance almost.
Yes,
yep.
I think it's just because of the shape, but people think always something to do with cutting hair, or there are these kind of jokes, you are the scissor hand man, or something like that. So people, I think, get different idea. They have really to go and watch. Even in Peru, it's not very well-known dance. Well, even now, has been granted by UNESCO this big title, but because of that, maybe a little bit more people are getting to know this dance. But because come from remote villages, most people just have reference of the name and a little bit of, they might have seen it on TV or something like that.
How important is music in the performance, and what music typically accompanies a scissors dance?
Well, music is very important because we have to dance to a certain music, and we have like different melodies. Every dancer should have a violinist and a harp player, which they have to play live in a traditional context. And you have these musicians, and the other dancer that you are competing to, he has his own musicians playing alongside them.
Right.
So, and we have like a development. First, we need like just we present ourselves to the audience, to everybody, like just a greeting. We call pasacalle. It's a little bit like walking in the streets, but it comes from the highlands. And then eventually we do some few steps that has reference some agricultural activity or maybe daily life activity, or imitates animal life or etc. Something from the highland environment. And then you go to do different steps like on the floor or maybe jumps, and eventually you ended up with something on tiptoes, kind of steps.
How would you describe the costumes? Earlier you mentioned that they're very colorful. You know, what are they exactly?
The costume is a little bit like, it resembles a little bit the Archangel's costume. I don't know if you are familiar with it. Archangels were a kind of angels, but in colonial painting. And they have like a costume which has a lot of golden and silver elements and a lot of decoration. But also because the highlands all by nature is like very colorful, and people like wearing very shiny colors and mix them all together in their attire. So the dance itself has a lot of these elements. And we wear, for instance, trousers, has I don't know how to describe, but it combines different kind of colors, which are mixed in some way. Is that they make like pattern.
Right. It sounds very striking overall.
Yes.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that you took a while to find somebody who could teach you because,
yes.
And that was partly due to the fact that it's generational and you have to find somebody who'd be willing to kind of deviate from that tradition.
Yes.
So what happened? How did you learn? When did you eventually find this person?
Well, I was at that time studying at the University of San Marcos, my art history course. And then someone was going to give like kind of a talk about scissor dance, and he was going to be a dancer. And then I went along, but I just was interested in what he was going to say. And afterwards, I had a chance to talk to him and say, really, I'm interested in learning. Could you be able to teach me? And eventually he agreed. But he was from another style, from another region, because we have like three different regions for this dance. And I learned a little bit a while with him. Sometimes he had to go to his hometown, so he wasn't all the time there. So in that time, because of him, and I went to different festivals, I knew that in Lima were happening a lot of festivals. I went to another one where I found another dancer from my region. I introduced myself and I managed to convince him that he could teach me. So I followed him to some other festivities in the countryside, also in the highlands,
mm-hmm.
As an apprenticeship kind of person. And eventually I was able kind of to compete with other dancers also in similar festivities.
What is the significance of this dance in terms of cultural identity in the Peruvian Andes, especially when it can be diversified to the extent that it has three, you know, distinct regions, three distinct styles? What does it mean to Peru?
Nowadays, I think because in Peru people kind of follow this the fact that can be named by UNESCO as intangible heritage. So that means the government first of all has to take some sort of action to promote and to preserve this dance, maybe to support the learning possibilities for other dancers to be able to learn also, and and explore with this dance some of our heritage. But I think because people are kind of getting to know more, are becoming more interested also. It means that you can kind of share with other countries your heritage. Yeah. It's kind of it becomes like symbol of a nation when this happens. So some people get proud, like, you know, our dance has been designed this, and I think that gives a empower them to do more things.
Yeah, that interested me earlier when you were saying that, you know, your work is very visual and not so textual. So when you perform a dance like the scissors dance, which is very visual, which is and which is not commonly known, do you feel a certain sense of responsibility to inform the people watching about what it is that they're watching? Or do you hope that the dance itself will represent something?
I tend to think that the second option will be best, but I think people need a little bit more information. Usually what I do is like, after a show, I try to have a like question and answer session so I can kind of explain, show the steps, and kind of let them know a little bit more about this, the background of the dance, and kind of illustrate them by showing the costume or how the scissors are moved. I allow some people to touch the scissors so they can kind of experience the heaviness or maybe try to play. But I think the dance is very, very, very abstract and very symbolic. Some of steps, as I said, maybe comes from agricultural activities, or maybe some jump represents that like the owl is flying, or the condor is flying, or maybe it's, the llama is jumping, or kind of these steps, or maybe an insect is going in a cave or something like that.
And you can't possibly explain all of that, you know. Yeah.
But when you dance, you just dance. I think people follow the movements. They are more interested in the movements and how you move, how you interact with the music, and experiencing that. But I think and I felt that many people go with many questions in their heads, but they say, what is really this all about? And they really want to know more about this. I feel like I need to inform. And I have a small hand program that I can distribute also before the show.
Your particular approach to this dance employs puppetry. How does this play out on stage?
First, I try, because before this performance, I had a different version, which was more ritualistic. Involved a little bit of acting, most of the rituals, like the offering, the laying down of the costume of the dancer in honor to honor the ancestor of this dance who left this heritage, and then dressing up in front of the audience, dancing, and at the end, ending up with some, what they call prueba de coraje, is proofs, like courage proofs, something like this. You insert like very sharp objects in your own body, in your own flesh, and carry heavy weights and so on. But this approach with puppetry, I think, is rather different because it mixes two art forms. And I feel that myself as a performer, sometimes I need to think as a puppeteer first. And it's difficult to connect from there to the dance, so I need to make a transition. I think when I become a dancer, I have a little bit of a problem at the beginning because it's like two different mentalities. Two different kind of states of mind.
That you're trying to bring together in one performance.
Yes. Yep. So it's kind of like a personal challenge to me. But at the same time, I think somehow I managed to become a scissor dancer on a stage. After making the puppet. So at the beginning, I dress up like everything in black costume. So I try to be as more neutral as possible so the people can focus on the puppets, on the objects being manipulated. And afterwards, I can kind of make my transition, dress up in front of the audience, and then slowly start my dance steps.
You mentioned in another interview that your concept works on the idea of mirror images, you know, where the puppets copy the dancer and vice versa. Could you expand on that?
Yes. what the audience notice that they at the beginning they don't understand why these puppets are moving this way or in that way. So different steps, different moves. And they try to relate to something. But they don't expect me to maybe dance. Some of them they just end up by accident, I don't know. And it's a little bit interesting, I think, dynamic that comes afterwards. And then when they see me dressing up, eventually they kind of make associations because the puppet's dress reflects my own dress.
Yeah.
And so in a way I become like a bigger version of a puppet or a human version of that puppet. And then because the puppets have been designed to be able to dance and make different steps that scissor dancer will do. So afterwards I can do the same steps as the puppets and that they can say, okay, it's like we see the puppets doing this, now it makes sense.
It's that mirroring.
Yes. But actually the departure is that the puppets copy first this tradition, the steps. And then as a puppeteer, I just represent this through this medium. And afterwards I become myself the dancer after being the puppeteer and trying to copy the puppet. So it's a little bit like three steps in one.
Yep. It sounds very complicated.
Yes.
So finally, you know, what can we look forward to at the show?
I think for any audience, even in Peru, I could say in some places, it's a little bit like you'll get to know something that you might haven't thought it might exist somewhere in the world because it's like kind of dance unique to Peru. You might share some common things with other dances in other places, but the fact that has this spiritual background linked to certain festivities in Peru and the fact that we use the scissors in one hand and at the same time dance, it makes kind of interesting for people to go and maybe discover this new expression for them. I think even in Europe, I mean, when I performed, I think I'm the only one who does this dance. So we are not so many, and it could be like a special opportunity for them to go and maybe be able to witness this this experience. And for me, it's a good opportunity to share with the Malaysian audience who could be able to be interested in other heritage. Maybe some theater makers or dancers that then they can take some inspiration from this and work on Malaysian topics, maybe with similar approach. That's a little bit my expectation.
You can catch the Ritual Scissors Dance from today, the 23rd, until Saturday, the 25th of January, with performances at 8:30 p.m. And matinee shows at 3 p.m. on the 24th and 25th at KL Pax Indocene, which is located at Sentul Park, Jalan Strakan, Kuala Lumpur. Tickets are at a flat rate of RM25, and you can call 03-4047-9000 for bookings. And for more info, do visit klpax.org. Thank you so much for joining me, Jose.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
I've been speaking to Jose Navarro, artist, on the topic of the Ritual Scissors Dance on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.